Now let's find out from our guest Colin Bennett why he calls his book The American Demonology. We'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you and Colin Bennett, our guest. Colin, your book, one of them, of course, American Demonology. How'd you come up with that title?
Oh, this is my new book, released on the 29th of this month.
Mm-hmm.
I called it American Demonology because it's a book about Operation Blue Book and the official United States Air Force investigation into UFOs in the 1950s. Why did I call it an American Demonology? Well, in discussing difficult and controversial areas such as paranormal, etc., spiritual experiences, I always emphasize history. You know, we've had the people in deserts see things. Our entire religious, Muslim religion, Christian religion, Hindu religion is based on meeting elemental creatures. I'm just asking people to consider the evidence here as far as culture is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not pushing anything down their throats. It's a basic human response to what Jung called constellate a system. For the Greeks, it was gods and goddesses. For the Jews and the Egyptians, something else. And for the Romans, something else. And for medieval Christianity, it was the order of angels. There's always some higher constellation belonging to the gross physical aspects of life. Now, in our own age, it is my opinion that the military-industrial complex is such a constellation. It's part physical, it's part abstract in the sense that we form many of our values from the benefits, if you like, or disadvantages of the military-industrial complex. It's what we refer to. We produce it, we live within it, and therefore it's a cosmological thing in the sense we form our moral values, our intellectual values from clever men and women who live in the military-industrial complex. We like its products, it's associated with consumerism and media, and this is our culture, and this is our cosmos. And now the Greeks had a word, demon, which is a daemon, which didn't mean an evil devil in the Christian sense. It meant a spirit. The military-industrial complex is the spiritual dimension, or part of it, in which we live, whether we like it or not. Star Trek, for example, is a perfect example of the military-industrial complex extended into media, entertainment,
mm-hmm.
the belief system. So an American demonology is about a belief system. You can reject it if you like, but then if you want to reject it, you have to reject, say, Christ's miracles, walking on the water, for goodness sake, you know, and feeding the 5,000. You reject those too. That's fine. You want to reject them, you reject them. But a culture is built around Christ's miracles. A culture is built around the miracles described in the Quran. And so human beings build culture not around facts, but around miraculous or spiritual or mystical experiences. And they live within this, what you could call a continuum, to which they refer. And the military-industrial entertainment complex is a continuum to which we refer in turn. You know, millions of people worship Michael Jackson, for example. These are modern-day, it's the opinion of quite a few people, these are modern-day shamans. And so I called my book An American Demonology in the sense that Captain Ruppelt of Blue Book describes an entire, the growth, of course, we're talking about early growth here in the 1950s, of not only a military-industrial complex, but a cultural complex to which people belong, to which they refer, and to which they form their values, with which they form their values. And that's why I call it an American demonology. It's nothing to do with the nasty devils from hell with hot tails. And
all right. The perception of UFOs in your particular case, do you believe they're extraterrestrial from other planets or other dimensions?
Other dimensions.
Ah.
I appreciate the extraterrestrial concept of aliens, which many scientists believe in now. But according to relativity theory, the messages we receive, they're all dead. There are insuperable problems there. I think that quantum physicists, for instance, are now freely talking. Quantum physicists such as Jack Sarfati, Dr. Jack Sarfati, for example, is a friend of mine, are freely talking about interdimensional things. And so are people, very solid, very sensible people, such as Bruce McAbee, are talking about sure. quantum wormholes, entrances, and so on. And these are scientists, and they're beginning to open out the interdimensional aspect of alien contact.
Are they physical once they get here?
I'm sorry, George, would you say that again?
Are they physical once they get here? They're in shape and in craft, physical structures?
So, yes, or partially physical, yes. The quantum worlds are very strange. I'm not a scientist. I'm an arts graduate. So, I'm speaking from the outside. But what I read about quantum speculations is that there are many, many aspects of being. And what is inferred, could be inferred from this, is that we see sometimes ghosts, etc., paranormal. We sometimes experience something of these transient quantum worlds. This is the current theory that's running among enlightened quantum physicists. The non-enlightened quantum physicists will think I'm talking nonsense.
See, and you talk about ghosts, that leads us right back to Charles Fort,
yeah.
who had this incredible urge for the paranormal. And
yeah.
It became his whole life, didn't it?
It became his whole life, yeah. Detecting hairline cracks in the scheme of things. Things don't fit together. And you can apply a Fortean analysis, for instance, to the unsolved mysteries around the Oswald case.
And by the way, I want to talk with you later about this Oswald case, because
yes.
it's always fascinated me, and the fact that you're writing a book on it, I want to chat with you about that. But back to Fort.
Okay, now, yes, and Fort's main idea was that you take a piece of experience. It could be hanging clothing on a washing line, and it breaks up, when it's analyzed, it breaks up into anomalistic sections. The world is fundamentally unstable. There is a book called The Assassins, which came out a few years ago, and it's about the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, here you have in this book a collection of 30 or 40 of very, very brilliant minds, top American journalists, scientists, speculators who know what they're talking about, who know what they're doing, or have all the information. They cannot put any 24-hour frame of Oswald's life into focus. So you have a crisis here in rationalism. that's what Charles Fort pointed out. You have all these brains, these resources. You try and put together a 24 frame of Oswald's life. And therefore the conclusion is this possible at all? I mean, Norman Mailer reaches the same conclusion in his book, The Oswald Tale. Here was something, and I'm quoting Norman Mailer here, Something beyond human can happen.
Something did indeed.
Yeah, that's Norman Mailer. And it sums up the Fortean point of view. You know, nothing could better express Charles Fort's point of view than that. Mm-hmm. That there is this central mystery which disappears rather like a mouse's tail into the floorboards.
Did Charles Fort, Colin, have any specific interest or expertise in the paranormal? Anything? Was it ghosts? Was it UFOs? Was it psychic phenomena? Was there any one thing?
It was the whole range. He wrote four books. The number one book is called The Book of the Damned. It was called The Book of the Damned because his idea was you have all these hairline cracks in reality, all these anomalistic question marks about the most basic experience. Yet we produce a system of management and allowances. It's not fact versus fiction in Fort. This is he replaced the fact versus fiction equation, if you like, with a series of allowances. We allow the alien. We allow this. We allow that because we allow as much as we can handle, as much as we can take. Because if you lift the stone, you know, everybody in this world has lifted a stone in a garden at least once in their life. and you see what's underneath.
Do you
cope with that in human terms? No. So what you do is manage it. In the simple, brutal consumer sense, you deny it.
Do you think Hollywood has been basically told by governments, let's ease into the UFO phenomenon and let's do movies on things like that, Contact, and those kinds of approaches to desensitize us, to get us ready? Or do you think it's just entertainment?
I think broadly that's true. But I would say that to do Hollywood, put Hollywood in the best light, they have to do things that we like, things which are glamorous, sexy, exciting, and who's to blame them for that? I would be a terrible Puritan to blame them for that. If they use the latest speculations, latest UFO speculations, I think this is a somewhat healthy approach. There may be manipulation behind it. There probably is. But, you know, in a communist society, this disappeared. And human beings, you know, were almost suicidal with despair. We need this input. It's part of our makeup. The animals are not like this. Only this human animal needs this amazingly glamorous science fiction speculation, which we all groove on. We love it. And we consume it. Without it, I mean, imagine being without Hollywood and its range over the 20th century. You would be a very miserable person if you rejected that. You would be a very miserable person if you rejected media entertainment. What kind of a person would you be?
Well,
it excites you.
Maybe
it excites you.
Maybe more schooled.
I'm sorry?
Maybe more schooled.
Maybe more schooled, yeah. Well,
I'd read more books.
Yeah, the thing is, from the moral point of view, I mean, when you didn't have Hollywood, when you didn't have media, the world was just as slaughterous.
Well,
the First World War was created without extensive media involvement.
In your work, Colin, did you ever come across the work of the late journalist? Because I used to read his books too on ufology, and just I was fascinated with what he did. Frank Edwards.
Oh yeah, Frank Edwards. Yeah, he's a classic writer.
One of the best.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Sure. Absolutely. Yes. He was in from very early on, his books were very, very sharp and brilliant and intelligent, and great loss. Really, we could do with Frank Edwards now. And he was very quick and astute. Yeah.
I think he was a believer, wasn't he?
Oh yeah. Oh sure. Yeah. Well, yeah. A lot of people are believers, mainly if only because of the simple fact that they have experiences. I have had a UFO experience myself.
Tell me about it.
Well, it fortunately it hasn't happened before. It doesn't happen again. It was about 25 years ago, I used to write plays, and I had a play on in a theatre in London. And I used to go to this play, to see this play, just meet my friends, etc., during the week several times. On this day, the phone didn't ring, and it was a very strange feeling. And no one called, and I was living by myself. And I decided to go to the theatre to see my friends. And I got to the theatre, and I cursed myself because the theatre was closed. It was Sunday. I'm sorry about this preamble, but I got back to Notting Hill Gate, and I was still at a bit of a loss. And there was a film playing at the Coronet Cinema there. It was a kind of semi-pornographic film, and I decided to go in and see it. And I thought to myself as I sat there, am I getting to the age where I go into theatres alone?
Oh,
pornographic films. I thought, well, yeah. There we are. And I came out of the theatre. The film was terrible. And I bought some cat food, and I got to the railings outside my flat. As soon as I got to the railings outside my flat, I saw a bright light in the sky. It was evening, and late evening, and it went straight to the back of my head. If it had been pure candle power, I'd have been blinded. It was. It went straight to the back of my head.
And you're sure it wasn't an airplane?
No. It was static. It was bright. It was moving very slowly. I then called down to the basement to my girlfriend, who lived in the basement, Karin, and I said, Karen, come and have a look at this. And she came out, and she was mounting the basement steps, and I thought, if she gets to the top of the steps and doesn't see what I am seeing, then I'd have to see a doctor or something. Or something. I never forget her face when she saw the thing itself. Well, a sense of relief came over me that someone else had seen it. And then we saw a truly fantastic thing. It's difficult to describe. I saw a Lancaster bomber static over Paris Square, and so did she. It was black. It was a Lancaster. It was static over there, as if it was suspended by a crane or something like that. This Lancaster bomber then morphed into a triangular craft and shot away. She was speechless. She was a very good witness. She was a very dour woman, a mathematics grad, no, a physics graduate, and she was in shock. And we then saw another light, which was racing across the heavens, much smaller light than the first one. Out of this light came the first few cycles of a sine wave and disappeared, a light sculpting a sine wave. And the whole phenomenon disappeared. We then went down to her flat, and we were quite speechless. I was speechless because there was a man in black sitting there. I thought, oh, my God, you know, a man in black.
That was fast, huh?
Yeah, it was fast, yes. The man in black was explained. He'd come to see a friend of his upstairs, and he wasn't in. And therefore, he knocked on Corin's door to be admitted while he waited for this person. I've never known Corin open. She was not the kind of woman to open a door to anyone. He was a nice, friendly guy, florid face, blonde hair, well-dressed, well-spoken, and very nice and very charming. He was in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why his connection with the guy upstairs. And he sat there and said, I can see you're both in shock. I can see, that I think I'll leave. I won't go see my friend now. And he disappeared. He made an excuse and left. And so we were there. And I said, I want to be alone. And she said, so do I. I went upstairs to my own flat. I took my cats in from the dustbin, went upstairs to my own flat, and bent down, giving the cats the food. And as soon as I straightened up again, I had a terrible shock. I'd lost time. I'd lost time. Yeah, I'd lost some time, yeah.
Hours?
I'd lost about half an hour.
Half an hour.
Yeah. I knew I had. I immediately leapt to the phone to try and catch the manager of the cinema. And I just caught him before he went. And I said, what time is it? What time does that show come down? And he gave me the time, and I couldn't square the half hour. My journey from the cinema to the cat food buying to the railings, I'd lost half an hour. It was a tremendous experience in my life. I never had anything like that.
Do you think you were abducted?
I have no idea about that. I didn't see any beings, and I've not been hypnotized, and I don't think I want to be. It wasn't the kind of, creepy. It was experience from an SF dark horror film. It was quite cool. That was the frightening thing about it. You know, you could have a cool experience which doesn't include melodramatic elements, if you know what I mean. It was quite a cool, calculating experience. It was almost as if I was subject of an experiment. It was something to do with the oobly-ooblies. And there we are. And I've written about that in the Phenomena magazine, and I got a tremendous response from it. And there we are. And people have these experiences, particularly in the Betty and Barney Hill case, which is a classic case.
Oh, it's got to be one of the best.
Yes, that's one of the best, indeed, yeah. And they reveal these things under hypnosis. And I believe in the reality of the hypnosis because in their case, the simultaneous twin structure, you'd have two people from the same unconscious. I mean, that is a bit of a...
Stay with us, Colin. We're going to take this break and come back, chat again. And I do want to ask you about Lee Harvey Oswald when we come right back. So what do you think UFOs are? Where do you think they come from? What's the reason? I'll take your phone calls next hour when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. But in a moment, our guest, Colin Bennett, let's chat a little bit about his investigation into the life of Lee Harvey Oswald. And welcome back to Coast, Colin Bennett, our guest. Colin, tell me why you started doing a book on Lee Harvey Oswald. Curious.
Well, it's one of the great subjects of the last century, and it ties in, rather like ufology, it ties in a lot of major areas. And Oswald as a character has always fascinated me. He's full of amazing question marks. It's almost straight out of the pages of a novel. As I said a few minutes ago, many books have been written to try and put a time frame, trying to clamp a system of reference onto Lee Harvey Oswald in the normal social psychological way, and all of them have failed to do so. It's very difficult to account for a single day of his existence. It's full of the most amazing anomalies and mysteries, as many as you can imagine. It's almost as if he's a living production rather than a human being. I mean, could you have anything more interesting than that? Also, as a person, he didn't have much going for him. He had a very, very elementary education, and a very rather poor family background. His mum was loyal, but his father, I think, disappeared early. And he was a truant at school. He was obviously a bit disturbed. So he didn't have a higher education, and yet he just crashes through 20th century walls as if they didn't exist. The first thing he does is join the Marines when he was 17. And he was based in Japan. Now, here's the first mystery. I, in my researches, the lot of books blandly say that Lee Harvey Oswald was a radar operator in the United States Marine Corps based in Japan. And if you just take an elementary look at American Marine electronics courses, before you're allowed even in the same room as an operational television set, you will see that the years don't add together.
True.
People talk about Lee Harvey Oswald as if he's got his hands on a radar set guiding in U-2s, of all things, top secret aircraft then, and also B-52s full of nuclear stores. He's guiding them in. You would have to be a top sergeant of at least 10 years experience before they let you do that.
But he was a good marksman, wasn't he?
He was an average marksman. He was an average marksman. Mm-hmm. Yes, he got a marksman's badge, but he wasn't incredibly brilliant, according to Marine records. That's the first thing, a mystery about Oswald. The time gap between radar training, the so-called radar training, hands-on important missions, no way that I can square. He would at least have had to an instruction period of at least 2.5 years. The radar course in the Marines then was 2 years. And then there was a 2-year apprentice course. Imagine, crashing B-52s full of nuclear bombs because you gave a wrong direction. That's the most risky job in the world. They would never let him near it. Mm-hmm. Never mind a U-2. So there's the first mystery. You say, okay, well, there's something very strange here. And then the second thing is that he's talking communism all the time to his mates.
Yes.
The Marine Corps. And studying Russian.
Almost as if they wanted him to do that.
Yeah. There's always this amazing shadow, of other dimensions over him in all kinds of ways. It just doesn't fit. I mean, that's where you start with Oswald. And of course, he leaves the Marine Corps. I think it was on compassionate grounds, and he doesn't want to be in the Marine Corps anymore. And then he joins the National Guard. The Marine I think there's a Marine section of the National Guard, I'm not quite sure, but he joins the National Guard, and he's given a dishonorable discharge because he doesn't turn up. His discharge from the Marines was not dishonorable, but his discharge from the Reserve was dishonorable. And he's talking communism all the time. And he then decides, of course, as we all know, to go to Soviet Russia. With all this knowledge, or no knowledge, of United States Marines radar, he takes off to Russia. His journey to Russia. All this is done without money.
Yeah, well, exactly. How did he do that?
He arranges everything. It's as if there's a tourist organization lifting him here, there, now, from hotel to hotel, mind you. And he gets to Russia without any money at all. And, of course, in Lee Harvey Oswald fashion, he lodges himself into the biggest hotel in Moscow as if he's Mick Jagger on a tour, you know. He's presiding over a Rolling Stone concert. He behaves like a film star, you know, a big rock star. It's an amazing guy, pulls it off. Who paid for the Hotel Moscow is called then? No one knows.
It's almost like he was either a double agent or a spy.
Or a spy, yeah. And the way he's carrying on, as I say, he's acting like a big film star lodging into a major hotel. And according to the bourgeois world, of course, he's nobody with nothing. So, but he's behaving like, as if he was, which is fine. Okay, I understand that. I have no problem with that. But how, the means of doing so are mysterious. Okay, he applies for Russian citizenship. Let us remember that Russia in those days was a pretty stiff place. You couldn't mess around with the Russians. And yet he messes around with the Russians like nobody's business.
And getting away with it.
Yeah, he gets away with it, yeah. He should have disappeared, vanished, vaporized. He goes into a hotel, as I say, and then he hurries the Russians up. What about my citizenship, then? And the Russians are completely baffled by this American imp on their horizon, I think. They were hypnotized by him. What about my citizenship? And the Russians reply in two or three days, which is slow for a Russian reply, you're not going to get Russian citizenship. Then he pulls a hat trick. He pulls a great star performance. He locks his door and he slits his wrists.
Well, now, I didn't know that.
Yes, oh, yeah.
He really slit his wrists.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Why?
Because he said that he was in despair, that they wouldn't give him citizenship. And he had an in-tourist guide there. Very sensible woman, probably an Asian. Most interiors people were. And she's supervising him in Moscow. So he's not only got a Moscow hotel, he's got an interiors agent, you know. He's got the word Asian indicates show business at all levels, you know. And she happens to go to call him, this hotel. And the door's locked. She's very suspicious. She calls security, and they batter the door down. There's Oswald, lying in the bathroom, covered in blood.
Almost dead.
Almost dead. They rush him to hospital, and they patch him up. And he's okay from then on. There we are. He's one star act.
So you don't think that was, well, do you think that was an act?
Well, I'm looking at, he might have died.
Yeah, I mean, that's... You're
within hours of death, yeah. If you'd taken a chance on that one. Yeah, if she hadn't called him, a very sensible, very stout kind of woman that the Russians employ on such missions, she sussed it, and they bet the door down.
Do you actually believe, Colin, that he acted alone in the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
No.
No. Not many people do anymore.
No. No, there was a framework. The thing is that it's always a mathematical problem to square the overall framework with the individual sectors. And this is everybody's big problem. Everybody knows this. There was a mafia involvement. There was a Cuban involvement. There was intrigues of all kinds. In criminal and varying shade of...
Yes, his personal life, everything.
It's personal, everything. And okay, you can perform. It's kind of a mathematical situation. You can have a mafia solution if you want. Then you can have a CIA solution if you want. And each separate solution gives you a solution, a partial solution, if you know what I mean. You can't sum the sectors.
Well, let's say this is how I look at things when they occur. I ask myself, who benefits? And then that's how you trace the trail.
Yeah.
In this
yeah.
particular case, after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, who benefited?
Well, there's 1,001 books on 1,001 shelves, which said that Johnson benefited.
Johnson, the industrial military complex that you talked about, they benefited because the Vietnam War just expanded and money was made there.
Yeah. This is the concrete solution. Yeah, I mean, but Kennedy himself, the bad blood came from Cuba. The bad blood came from Bay of Pigs, the betrayal of the Bay of Pigs.
Yes.
I never forgave him for that. There was the resources, there was a whole spectrum of resources which went into the Cuban exiles' invasion. And he refused to give them air cover, as you know, from Guantanamo, yeah, and from a carrier. And they were wiped out.
And they were expecting it.
Yeah. They took a risk. They thought he would give them air cover, but Kennedy wouldn't give them air cover. And they landed, of course, without air cover, and Castro's forces wiped them out. And everybody lost a lot of money, a lot of money. Then, of course, there was involvement of the gangsters, Giancana and so on.
Who lost a lot of money in Cuba as well.
In Cuba. Oh, yeah, previously, too. Yeah. And they paid for the invasion forces, too, in private means. For Oswald is at the center of this. And as I say, he when he's in Russia, they put him to work in a radio factory. They send him to Minsk. And then he meets Marina, and they get together. They live. They get married, or they have a child. And the serious thing is that his room, he has quite a nice apartment, which is most unusual. And he earns twice as much as anybody else, of course. In Oswald, yeah. And they give him a wages two or three times more than any other fellow worker's having. They give him an apartment, which is better than any other worker, and he takes Marina, he marries her, they have a child in his apartment. This apartment, citing Norman Mailer here, and also Weber, it's bugged. It's got cameras in it, it's got microphones all over the place. Norman Mailer has found the KGB transcripts of the Oswald Marina rows. They rowed often.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got the KGB transcripts over in his book. And you can tell it's a kind of soap opera. He's, you know, that the people who say there was some kind of very deep psychological manipulation of Oswald on a new high-tech level would have to account for the time. He's rowing with Marina most of the time. And there's camera of them moving about in the room for months. And he knows a lot of people. And his hours at the Minsk factory and with Marina and with Marina's friends are all accounted for. There's no big time gap in which you'd have to get hold, in which it was possible to get hold of him and manipulate him in the Manchurian candidate sense, you know.
Right.
I mean, the Manchurian candidate is a very good model for all this. But you had to get hold of him for a considerable long period of time, in theory, yeah. There's nothing happened to Oswald like that. He led a perfectly normal row in which life in Moscow, in which he had normal human relationships, good, bad, and indifferent, with a lot of people. And so then, in the middle of this normality, he breaks it. Like he's showing. I hate to use these amateur psychiatric terms, but he's showing a certain kind of schizophrenia. Suddenly he decides he's had enough. And this is a wonderful star act. This is, you know, talk about petulance. The communists and Marxists suddenly decide that Russia is far too dull for him.
He's coming back home.
He's coming back home. And he shows a sense of humor in his diary. There's a diary. In which he says, if I go to another trade union dance, I'll scream. Isn't that wonderful? In other words, the dullness of Russian life did him in, finally. He wants Coca-Cola and all-night TV. And he wants to get back to America. That's one of the great star turn. And, of course, the great mystery is the Russians are tolerating all that. They say to themselves, oh, I see. He wants to go back to America. Oh, yes. Well, that's okay. What?
Yeah, I mean,
take a Russian woman?
So do you think he was a double agent or a spy from us spying over Russia? Who do you think he was?
The question, I'll answer one other thing just a second. The question of him being an agent of any kind is based on, you know, the good old pay dirt principle. What's the use of all this elaborate plotting and money and expense if he's getting no knowledge to you? He had no access to anything in Soviet Russia.
Unless he had a purpose.
Unless he had a purpose, but the purpose is certainly not giving information to American intelligence. I mean, what you got out of Oswald Rush's experience was that he worked in a factory, in a very conventional radio factory.
Do you think the Russians wanted Kennedy dead?
Well, this was Khrushchev's great era, and that is possible.
Yes.
Kennedy was a powerful man. He made them back down, and I don't think they ever forgave that.
I remember a theory, too, Colin, which was the strangest of all of them, that Aristotle Onassis wanted him out in order to get Jackie.
Yeah, I think there's that part of the intrigue, too, yeah. There's,
and maybe they were all in it together, all of them.
Well, yeah, I mean, Shakespeare would have painted this canvas. He would have brought them all in.
Yep.
I often, when I get confused about this thing, and you can often get confused, Lee Harvey, is to think about how Shakespeare would have seen it. And he would have seen this canvas, this amazing canvas. But there's very few 20th century characters have created such an incredible canvas as Lee Harvey Oswald. And the irony is at every point, he was never proved that he did anything in court of law. Never proven in a court of law that he did anything bad at all.
Well, he was gunned down. We never had a chance, I guess.
He didn't have a chance, no. But the gunning down, of course, is one of the greatest mysteries of all time. It's one of the great world mysteries in the whole of history. His behavior was Roswell's behavior seemed to indicate, and I'm going out on a limb here, I shouldn't say this, perhaps, is robotic, as if he is conditioned. He left the book depository when all hell was let loose in Dallas. He goes back to his bed-sit rooming house. He wasn't living with Marina at that time. She was taken in by Ruth Payne and the kid. They were impoverished, etc. He goes back to this rooming house and stays there for about 8-10 minutes. He then decides, in his wisdom, to go out for a walk in the middle of, you know, the whole of Dallas is exploding. He doesn't seem to be a part of it. He goes out for a walk. A patrol car comes up behind him, driven by patrolman Tippett. And Oswald turns and shoots him dead. It was along not a very frequented avenue that they start ringing the bells. There's a policeman being killed. And so the whole of Dallas Police Department suddenly has that on top.
Mm-hmm.
Oswald then walks to the local cinema and goes in. Now, this is robotic, if you like. Goes into the cinema without buying a ticket. Can you believe this?
Yeah. Now, how do you do that?
He got in without buying a ticket. The manager... someone tells the manager, there's a guy in there, he's just walked in, he's not gone to the box office, he's walked in, he's sat down. The manager says, I'm going to call the cops.
When does this book, Colin, come out?
In about spring next year.
All right. That's going to be a fascinating one, too. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back with your phone calls with a question I shall ask you in a moment. Our guest has been Colin Bennett. Right here on Coast to Coast AM.